Hello and welcome to EW's Best of Shows, Entertainment Weekly's weekly look at the best of television and the rest of television. Emphasis this week on the rest, at least with regards to one show we'll be talking about. I'm Darren Franich, a TV critic at Entertainment Weekly, joined as always by my brilliant colleague, the Milo Minder Binder to my major, Kristen Baldwin. Kristen, how's it going this week?
Well, Darren, let me just tell you that this morning on my way in on the subway, I discovered that there was a large tear in the butt of my jeans.
No!
And I was given some riders on the 2-3, a little bit of a show. And long story short, TJ Maxx was open, and I am now wearing emergency pants.
Wow! Incredible! TJ Maxx!
Yes, to the rescue.
That's good. This could almost be a subplot. If it were not a subway, it could be a subplot on LA's Finest. That's the only thing holding it back. There'd be it, like, I'm not sure that TJ Maxx would factor into it.
No, maybe there would be a robbery at the TJ Maxx, and then they would start tossing quips back and forth.
We gotta save it for later. We're holding off. We're talking about LA's Finest later on. We'll also be addressing the new season of Fleabag. So much to talk about there. But first, Kristen, as I teased a little bit in the introduction, we're getting literary this
Yeah,
week.
Let's do it. We're going to kick things off with our What's New segment, in which Darren and I talk about this week's most notable new and returning show premieres. So first up, we've got Catch 22, which premieres on May 17th. On Hulu. So Joseph Heller's classic novel about an average guy trying to keep out of harm's way in the face of an increasingly unstable insanitarian regime is both timeless and timely. Hulu's 6-episode adaptation, which is exec produced by George Clooney and was shot on location in Italy, is absolutely gorgeous to look at with its aerial shots of the Mediterranean Sea and its cast of impossibly handsome actors who thankfully can also act. Christopher Abbott stars as John Yosemite, a World War II bombardier who just wants to go home alive, but the maddeningly circular bureaucracy of the military keeps conspiring against his efforts. There's the titular catch, which essentially boils down to a soldier can be grounded for being crazy. All he has to do is ask to be grounded. But if you ask to be grounded, you must not be crazy, so you have to keep flying. Further complicating Yosarian's life is Colonel Cathcart, played by Kyle Chandler, who keeps upping the number of missions the soldiers need to fly before they can go home. So, Darren, this is a largely faithful adaptation that preserves a lot of Heller's brilliantly sort of elliptical prose, and the series features some really wonderful performances, primarily Kyle Chandler, who is hilariously apoplectic as Colonel Cathcart, a man who inspires and humiliates his men by shouting at them angrily in public forums. George Clooney was originally supposed to play this role, but he ended up taking a smaller part, General Scheisskopf, and I think the change ends up being good for the show. And Chris Abbott gives a very subtle but good performance as Yosarian, who may be a sane guy, but he's also often selfish and unlikable. But for me, Catch-22 ended up being something I admired more than sort of enjoyed and felt. It's very funny, but more often than not, it was the kind of funny where you nod and think to yourself, hey, that's funny, rather than actually feeling moved to laugh. And it felt almost a little too perfect to me, like it's art directed within an inch of its life. But for me, it was the kind of thing where this very specific and beautiful aesthetic sort of overpowered the actual emotion of the story. What do you think, Darren?
Kristen, I entirely agree with everything except for the admired part. I really want to give this show, like, you know, teacher gives extra credit to kid who is at least trying hard, because it is trying to adapt one of the greatest novels ever written. Yeah. I mean, like, I just think that Catch-22, there's kind of a reason why it is such a kind of continual rediscovery for each generation, because it's a book that I think kind of most often read in high school or kind of mm-hmm. early college. You know, it's just so funny and so fast and so quick, and yet what it is grappling with are just all of these incredible philosophical existential issues, and the way that it moves between all those registers characters while always being so absurd and so funny, and then when you least expect it, so moving. I just don't think that, even in the canon of like the books that everyone who reads has read, I still feel like it really kind of stands apart for me just for being a book that you can kind of crack open and flip to a random chapter, and it's just going to immediately enthral you. And you know, I don't know what the movie, TV, motion picture version of that would be. It seems like it would need to be something that is as intensely thoughtful as, you know, the most foreign art film, but also as funny as 30 Rock.
Right.
You know? And I just, and you know, I acknowledge that it's hard for me to pick out what is a thing that is similar to that. But yeah, as you said, it kind of seems like the big idea for this show was let's make it look good, which I don't think is even necessarily the best instinct for this material.
Right.
I do think that I really love Christopher Abbott, and I'm really glad that he's getting a role like this. A lot of people will remember him as Marnie's boyfriend on Girls, a role that he kind of left early on and then came back in one of the best episodes of television of this entire decade. And I'm glad to see him getting this kind of work. I think he's very good in a role that I'm not quite sure the show nails. I mean, Yossarian is kind of the central elliptical character in a very elliptical novel. And I think the fact that Abbott kind of manages to even get at some of the humor and sadness of the character is pretty impressive. But yeah, for me, Kristen, I couldn't get through the whole show. I only watched a few episodes. And the only thing that really stuck out to me as a triumph was Kyle Chandler as Colonel Cathcart. He is locked into what the show should be, right? Or at least he's kind of finding the right tone.
It's as though Coach Taylor were giving a locker room speech, but minus all the empathy and all the humanity. He's so committed blindly to this mission count that he keeps raising for no reason. And he's also just, you know, he punishes the bombardiers at one point, the plane, Yossarian's crew, by not serving them baked Alaska when everybody else gets baked Alaska. And he's like, this is yummy, isn't it, guys? And it's just so crazy. His performance is more unhinged, I think, than really anybody else's. Everything else just feels a little too perfect.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds crazy, but I feel this way sometimes about Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is a show I really enjoy. But at times it is like there's so much effort and focus put on the way the show looks and how everything is choreographed, even if people are just walking down the street, and the speech rhythms, the dialogue is so fast and it's so perfect, but it's almost like it's so perfect that it's devoid of actual feeling. So that is a little bit how I felt about this, although I do think that Kyle Chandler is just like living his best life in this role.
Well, and you know, Kristen, something you just said really sparked for me another issue, is that you know, we do have this cast of sort of handsome young men
playing
all the different pilots.
Everyone is so handsome.
Very handsome people, but it does feel as if, I'm trying to think of how to say this kindly. It's almost as if, like, you know, so Clooney, who, you know, directs a couple episodes, and he produced this with Grant Heslov, it almost is as if they kind of cast a lot of people who look a lot like kind of 40s era
dudes.
They
absolutely,
you know, like,
did.
And I think that's really wise, but it contributes to a feeling that, you know, when viewed all in a mass, as they often are on the show, they all kind of feel collectively a little cookie cutter to me.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, this is just one problem with adapting a book. For one thing, in the book, they all have insane names.
Yes.
You know, like, I mean, this is the book of like Milo Minderbinder and the book of, you know, John Yossarian. And, you know, it immediately makes them all stand out from each other. Whereas here, it's almost as if you're watching a slightly quirkier band of brothers at times. And I think it's just hard because, again, there are, you know, these moments with Kyle Chandler, who just is both that old school kind of guy and a total parody of that.
Yes.
And he's able to do that by virtue of the roles you associate with him, and by virtue of the fact that he can be just insanely funny, but never really blinking at all. There's something so deadpan about him. And I just sort of feel like, you know, as we're moving through all the other characters, this show very much tries to capture the ensemble nature of the book. You just sort of, there's a clear lack of that kind of energy when you're focusing on really a lot of the other characters. Kristen, you actually finished all six episodes, right?
I did.
How did you feel? Is this something that as it went along, you felt better about it? Are there reasons why someone like me, who's not so set on it, should try to finish it?
You know, it's interesting because I haven't read the book in a while, and it did make me want to go back and read the book, which if any, you know, piece of television ever makes you want to go back and read, I feel like that's a victory. So we should say thank you to Hulu for that. I think probably the fact that, you know, the book jumps around time-wise. You know, it's going forward in time, backwards in time. You're never quite 100% sure where you're going to land. And for the most part, this story is told, you know, in a linear fashion, which makes sense. You know, it's television. It's a little harder to get across. So there are certainly flashbacks and things like that, but it's mostly told in a linear fashion. And I think that actually does sort of de-emphasize and devalue a little bit the more emotional moments that happen later in the book. This is not a spoiler, people. This book has been out since 1961. For example, the death of Snowden, which is very, very important to Yossarian's narrative and his mental sort of shift in the book. And the reason I think, you know, it's more powerful in the book is because, you know, you keep going back to it, and you don't know what actually happened until later in the book. And in this, you know, it happens just as it happens in the book, but there's no, it just sort of happens in a vacuum in a way. There's a brief flashback to it in the beginning, but you don't know what it's about. And I think, you know, it's still very, like, it's a horrible moment what happens, but it's less powerful. So it's hard to say. I mean, it's beautifully well done. It's probably better than spending your time watching Double Shot at Love with Pauly D and DJ Vinny or whatever, which I watch.
Disagree.
Every week.
Disagree.
So, I mean, I guess I would say that it's certainly, and, you know, everyone's so good looking and it's very beautifully shot and it's, you know, it's faithful. It doesn't do too much to change the story. There are a couple things that are dropped, a couple things that are added that are probably, you know, I didn't love, but it's fine. So, you know, I guess I would say generally, if you're looking for something to watch and you know, like handsome men, then check it out. They're all decent actors. I think the kid who plays Milo Minderbinder is fantastic. His name is Daniel David Stewart, and he's really funny in this, I think. It's an insane role, but he has a lot of charisma. So I definitely think there's some good performances. And if you like Kyle Chandler, then 100% check this out.
Yeah, maybe the move is to sort of switch off episodes of this with episodes of Chernobyl, just as far as being like, you know, this is like, you know, it equally bleak at times, but the sun is shining and there's a lot of shirtless scenes, mm-hmm. like, you know, and when they're shirtless, they're not absorbing radiation the way a lot of characters on Chernobyl. Kristen, Catch-22 debuts on Hulu on May 17th, the very same day that a new season of television everyone should definitely watch debuts on Amazon Prime. Kristen, I'm talking about the return and I guess ending of Fleabag. Some background here: in 2016, actress and writer Phoebe Waller-Bridge astounded audiences across the English-speaking world with the debut season of her dramedy Fleabag, a kind of relationship show / family sitcom, which starred Waller-Bridge herself as a never entirely named fourth wall breaking young 30-something, generally referred to as Fleabag. Season one was a delirious raunch fest full of sexy, goofy times and a deep abiding sadness, but the long-awaited season two goes off in a slightly different direction as Fleabag attempts to clean up her life and finds religion, wink to the camera. Kristen, I reviewed the new season of Fleabag in the magazine. I liked it a lot. What did you think, and how do you feel in general about Fleabag? It feels like when the first season came out a few years ago, it was a real phenomenon for a lot of people.
It was, and it's funny, I didn't watch it, and then, over time, it sort of, you know, it was a huge hit in the UK, and then over time, it became sort of a word-of-mouth hit, as these shows generally are, and as Phoebe Waller-Bridge's star began to rise in general, people were checking it out, and it became something where a lot of people were obsessed with it here in America as well, and so, but, you know, knowing that, and knowing that now, between 2016 and 2019, you know, Phoebe Waller-Bridge has become a huge star, and sort of this sought after writer, she's spiffing up a Bond script, and, you know, she created Killing Eve, blah blah blah. I figured, okay, I'll check it out. And, you know, it's not something that you really need to have seen season one to watch. And I ended up really, I thought, oh, okay, I'll watch one or two. The first one, I thought, oh, this is well done. I'm not sure I'm loving it. But then I kept watching. And then pretty soon I was done with the season. It's six episodes. It's, you know, half an hour episodes. There is not a wasted moment. There's not a wasted shot. It's probably the most efficient storytelling and that we've seen in the streaming era.
It really skips right along. And that first episode you're talking about, for me, that's really one of the standout episodes of the year so far. Fleabag is kind of having this get together with her family, and it's kind of the first time you're told immediately that 1 year has passed from season one. There's a lot of incredible stress placed on the family in the first season, which I'm sure you picked up on.
Yes.
You know, there's this kind of ongoing wonderful dynamic with her sister Claire, who's played by Sean Clifford, and I mean their dynamic together, it just really raises the show to another level whenever they're together on screen. Of course, there's also her dad, played by Bill Patterson, and her dad's fiance, played by, oh my gosh, is that Olivia Colman?
It is!
What is she doing everywhere right now? That first episode also introduces a new character to the show, a cool, sweary Catholic priest who's played by Andrew Scott, an actor that I think a lot of people will know on these shores for his role as Moriarty in Sherlock. Very different role for him here. There's an interesting chemistry that strikes up between him and Fleabag in the first episode. And the sort of direction of them hanging out together defines a lot of season two in general, Kristen.
Yeah.
And one thing that I try to get into in my review is that this is kind of a quote-unquote religious season of television in a way that for me feels very sincere, even if it's also very, very funny.
Right.
I would almost kind of compare it a little bit to the Hulu series Rami that we've talked about recently, in that it's kind of another late 20, early 30-something who enjoys, you know, going out and hooking up and partying, has a bit of a religious awakening. I'm sort of, you know, straining towards this because the show is obviously still not quite with that exactly, but I found that to be a very interesting turn for the show in general.
It is, and it's interesting because, you know, there's, if you haven't watched season one, again, it ended in 2016, so don't at me when I say it ended with this revelation that was, you know, the reason Fleabag has been so miserable and heartbroken and guilt-ridden is because she slept with her best friend's boyfriend, and then her best friend, in an attempt to make her boyfriend feel guilty, was going to step in front of a bike, and she ended up getting killed. And so she's now, Fleabag is now a year later, you know, she's tried to put her, put all that bad behavior behind her. She's no longer having meaningless sex. She's trying to eat healthy, which apparently in the UK means avocado toast. and, you know, she's trying to mend fences with her sister, who they've had this sort of falling out in the finale. And what I think is really interesting about it is that it's very, realistic and relatable to think, you know, yes, she doesn't believe in God, but she also is yearning for the idea of like, what is it like to have a life with meaning? You know, what is it like to have a life where you really believe in something? And I think that's why she's drawn to the priest. He's just known as the priest, that, and he's really effing hot, you know? And so they do have this very interesting relationship. And there's so much great stuff that happens between her and her sister over the course of these six episodes. I had the opportunity to interview the cast for the premiere, and Sean Clifford had said, you know, the real love story of this show is between Fleabag and her sister. And I think that's, you know, really the truth. And it's for all the, you know, shock value of the, you know, humor and the sex that happens in season one and to some degree in season two, it really is this lovely love story between these sisters.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with the feeling that those two together, they just seem to really have this wonderful spark and this great chemistry. Wallerbridge and Clifford, I believe, have been friends for a long time, but there's just such a great natural rhythm that they find together. And, you know, I just think it's very interesting how this show, especially in its first season, you know, it came on in a very strong and hilarious and wonderful way as like a kind of raunchy and funny and, you know, kind of in your face show. And it's just really interesting to me to see how, you know, Waller Bridge, as she's gone off in these other directions and she's been in a Star Wars movie, and you mentioned she's, you know, helping to spiff up the next James Bond movie. And, you know, she kind of worked on the first season of a very funny, sexy, wild spy show. It's almost like she's come back to this material, which feels in general a lot more autobiographical and even a little confessional, and really kind of pushed it in an exciting new direction. So I just feel like to do all of that and also have just a really fun, fast-paced, you know, sitcom banter. There's a couple of great guest appearances this season. It's not that much of a spoiler to say that, like, Kristen Scott Thomas has an incredible guest role in one episode. That's
and
just so
Fiona
fantastic.
Fiona Shaw shows up in, I believe, episode 2, and she's freaking perfect. And it's, you know, watching her act opposite Phoebe Waller-Bridge is really fantastic. And I also, Brett Gelman, who I had only really known from Camping, that HBO show where he played sort of a similar character, but was quite funny in that show. He plays Claire's husband, Martin, who Fleabag hates, and she has good reason to hate. And that first episode really does, sort of centered on their dynamic with each other, and it comes to a head in a quite hilarious way.
Yeah, he's sort of the one character in the main cast of the show that can feel like there's a little bit of an over-the-top quality to him. But, you know, that's kind of why that first episode is so great, is that, you know, it's just such a marvel of, you know, almost kind of play-written tension, where you just have all these people at a table, and you're very aware that they are all just lit fuses of dynamite waiting to go off, and you're just waiting to see what's going to happen. I just think that, you know, as a performer, Phoebe Waller-Bridge is really incredible. And, you know, again, she's giving this whole performance both to the other characters and also to the camera. And the way that she breaks the fourth wall, I just think is really distinctive and unique. And it makes you feel as if you're watching someone give two performances simultaneously in the middle of like certain sentences. And I think there's nothing else like that. But it's just great to see her as a writer and as a kind of creator kind of keep developing too. It is one of these sort of, this is like a classic like British sitcom where, there were 6 episodes 3 years ago and 6 episodes now, and they've said it's over now.
Yes,
so it's easy to discover
it's
it,
It's so easy to discover. And, you know, it's interesting because she said, and so has Sean Clifford said, that, you know, this is it. And the ending of season 2 is perfect, I think. I mean, the ending is really beautifully well done, perfect ending for this character, and it's satisfying, it's heartbreaking, it's, you know, bittersweet, but it's a perfect ending. And, you know, people keep asking Phoebe Waller-Bridge, like, could there be more? Could there be more? And I really, really, really hope that she doesn't do more. I mean, I know that that's not, you know, sometimes people are like, why wouldn't I want more of a show that I love? And it's like, because it ended in a really perfect way. And she said more than once, and she said during the cast interview that I did, that she really thinks this is a good ending. She says, I'm supposed to say never, but I think she means never. Of course, she said this after season 1, too. So what she did say is what she'd like to do maybe is revisit the character when she's 50. Which, great, go ahead. But I think for now, the way the story ends is really beautiful. And it's so simple to go back and watch the first 6 episodes, you know, just and this 6 episodes, and it's just a nice little story, and it's a perfect example of it's okay to let stories end. It's okay. Let's do it, TV. Let's let them end.
Yeah, let them end. If you need, you know, you can continue on with the same people, and they can just do something different together. That's always a fun thing, you know. Like I think that you know Ryan Murphy seems to have generally figured that out. Although eventually they do wind up playing the other characters that they played. But you know, that's like, I would love nothing more than for Phoebe Waller-Bridge and Sean Clifford to do something else together.
And Olivia Colman.
Well, I mean, and Olivia Colman. It's so great her being on this show. is just sort of one victory lap in between the various other victories that she is doing recently. After winning the Best Actress Oscar, she's going to be in The Crown coming up pretty soon. But she's just so delightful. And I do think that, you know, as much as there's maybe an urge to see more of this show, I just think that with these performers, rewatching it will never lose its luster.
Exactly.
You know, like,
so,
like
yeah,
you know,
very...
you'll always be able to watch more by just going back around to the beginning.
It's very rewatchable. So let's all just get behind season two of Fleabag and say thank you and good night to Fleabag, and let's let it lie. I'm talking to you, Amazon, and any other exec who could make more money off of future seasons. Just do the right thing, damn it. Do it.
Do the right thing. And that's true of you out there, listeners. May 17th, Fleabag, Amazon Prime. Check it out.
Also,
no one be
more about gel coat.
When the fourth round would...
Don't you call in the...
Don't touch that dial. That's right, we're still calling it a dial here, because it's Emmy season on The Awardist. With the dazzling Oscar season behind us, we are now turning our attention to smaller screens to track which shows are headed to the podium and which shows stopped us in our tracks. Join me, Jared Hall, Entertainment Weekly's executive editor, as well as EW's TV-obsessed staffers, every Thursday starting April 4th, as we share our opinionated hot takes and insight into the Emmys race. The Awardist will get behind the scenes with the creators and stars themselves during in-depth, can't-miss interviews. Follow the long road to the Emmys with The Awardist podcast, Thursday starting April 4th, on your favorite podcast platform, and be sure to check out more Emmys coverage at EW.com/awardist.
Oh, Kristen.
Oh,
I don't know. Should we just leave off on that? That's such a good note. We've had a good time so far.
We got to do this, Darren. It's that time. It's that time that we talk about a little show premiering May 13th on Spectrum On Demand, which is a thing that is not available in all parts of the country, but is apparently available in some. It's a internet and cable provider, I believe. It's out there on your coast, yes.
I have Spectrum,
okay.
Which means I would theoretically be able to access this show,
okay,
if I so desired, which is a big if
big,
at this
big
point,
if. So
Kristen.
Here on the East Coast, we can't watch it, but I'm sure eventually that will change. But anyway, LA's Finest premieres May 13th on Spectrum On Demand. So this is a loud action dramedy. Okay, Gabrielle Union reprises her Bad Boys 2 role. Here she plays Sydney Burnett, a DEA agent turned LAPD detective who spends her downtime racking up one-night stands. And her partner, Nancy McKenna, played by Jessica Alba, is the opposite. She's a married stepmom who pouts when you miss her family book club. Together, Sid and Nancy, literally, Sid and Nancy. They trade quips during shootouts. The opening episode is them, you know, there's a convenience store shootout and they're arguing with each other as they shoot the bad guys, and ha, isn't that funny? Anyway, they trade quips during shootouts and hide dark secrets. And there are plenty of fine actors wasted in this show. One includes Evan Handler from Sex and the City. He's sort of the boxy suited, blustering Captain Hirsch. Ernie Hudson plays Sid's father, and, you know, doesn't have a whole lot to do. The good news is that you really can only watch this if you live in the parts of the country that Spectrum covers. So you can avoid it very easily if you want. Oh, another actor who is wasted in this show, not wasted like drunk, which, by the way, I wouldn't blame him at all, but wasted in that he is a nice actor and he should have better shows, Zach Guilford from Friday Night Lights. Anyway,
he's trying so hard in this show.
Bless his heart.
He's bringing his like AAA game to this show.
To some really CCC or F material. I don't know. Darren, the question I have for you is like, huh?
Kristen, you gave this show a C- in the magazine.
Yes, I did.
And I don't tend to disagree with you. And And to be honest, I'm not sure I disagree with you here, because my only response is I'm not sure there's a grade low enough for this show. You know, and Kristen, there's something really fascinating about LA's Finest, not the show itself, but like what kind of went into it. This is a spinoff of the Bad Boys franchise. And, mm-hmm. you know, we can all agree to disagree on things. I don't like either of the Bad Boys movies. There is a kind of fascination with Bad Boys 2 that I think a lot of people, especially my age, have. And like fandom for it even kind of weirdly inspired the action parody Hot Fuzz, directed by Edgar Wright. Huh. I just kind of think that like they're both dumb movies. And so the idea of saying we're going to do that, but with strong female characters, for me, it's already kind of a, well, okay. I mean, I'm not sure this is a thing that should be done again with any kind of characters, but right. you know, if this is your intention, if you're kind of taking it in a new direction, you know, I will at least check it out. And it just feels like a real strange and kind of misbegotten project all over the place, Kristen. And one of the interesting things about LA's Finest is it's almost an interesting example of all of these things that didn't used to be cliches, but now they are.
Yes.
The show is kind of nominally a kind of action comedy procedural, but we find out very early in the pilot that it is also kind of telling this longer serialized story, and every main character kind of has these mysteries and these secrets that yeah. they're keeping. And I think there was a time, even as recently as like 4 or 5 years ago, where that would have been, if not still unusual, then at least kind of exciting. It would have been like, oh, wow, this is not merely a procedural. It is telling this longer right. story. But by now, it actually seems as if it would do the show more justice to just be the sort of weekly shoot 'em up, right?
Exactly.
Like, well, whenever they sort of tease this longer story. And by the way, the longer story is a real bummer. I mean, I don't even know if we should get into it or not, but it involves just some awful backstory.
Yeah,
it's
like people.
Sad.
Yeah, like it involves some really bad guys doing bad things to you know, seemingly decent people. And
yeah.
it's just, I agree with you that it really would have maybe just been better if this had been a loud action dramedy where everybody yeah. just, you know, they caught the bad guys every week. And it frustrates me that they're supposed to be strong female characters, but the way that they make them strong female characters is like Gabrielle Union's character is all like, I have one night stands and I have, you know, to-go coffee cups by my door because I want people to get, you know, I want them to leave. I want it to be, you know, I don't want to get attached, you know. And then like Jessica Alba's character, she's got like a handsome but very dull husband and a rebellious stepdaughter. And it's, I don't know. It just feels like they're not even giving them interesting characters. And then,
yeah.
and then terrible stories and then badly sort of cliche shoot 'em ups with
totally.
You know, with a lot of sound bites in between.
And sort of the worst kind of cliches too, Kristen. This show fits very squarely into the grand tradition of like shows about yuppie cops. And like, to the point where it even kind of feels like this show is very explicitly about like very fancy people who are like taking out the less fancy people in town. There's a moment
right.
in I believe it's in the first episode where like someone sort of talks about how there was a shootout and they describe it as two bangers trolling Malibu, and there's a lot Ooh. Of like there's a lot of sociopolitical badness just worked up even in that statement, and then this idea of like, you know, the cartels are coming to the beach cities and
yes.
but you know, even kind of digging that deep into it, I just feel like I'm giving the show way more credit than it's worth. I mean I am fascinated sometimes by just like some of the even like stylistic choices of the show, Kristen, are like kind of funny in their own right. Like Jessica Alba's character, she's all about those like long cardigans.
Yes.
Like she's like that's kind of like that's like the cool new look for the LAPD.
Well, long cardigans over a camisole that shows her cleavage. for sure.
And even like, you know, you kind of mentioned how, you know, Gabrielle Union, who was just on Being Mary Jane, which is a really delightful show that I hope people check out instead of this. You know, you kind of mentioned how, yeah, she has like these one night stands. She's kind of casually bisexual, which is an interesting new trope on television.
Yes.
And I'm trying to think of how to talk about this because, you know, I am an old married person now who doesn't know much about how the youth socialize. It feels to me as if this new trope of like the badass bisexual lead female character, it can feel like it's going in the wrong direction at times. And there's a moment in the third episode where her character has been kind of hooking up with a woman. And like the woman shows up and is wearing like shorts so short that like she might as well be wearing a thong. And you're kind of just like, I'm not sure this is good for anybody.
Yeah.
It feels a little beefcakey, almost in the kind of 90s USA primetime show.
Yes, it's very like, this is progress? Question mark.
Yeah. So, but it's just, I mean, I don't know, Kristen, again, this is sort of, even as a sort of fun, over-the-top action show, I'm not really sure this gets there. Because it does, it's like whenever it's trying to be fun, it'll kind of get dragged down, again, with some really bummer and serious material. Very grim.
There's the requisite, like, guy being beaten to a pulp by, you know, other bad guys, and, you know, all the sort of requisite, like, light torture and stuff like that. I'm not surprised to report, though, that NBC had the option for the show and then passed on it. Which, you know, congrats NBC on making that decision, because I don't think that this show should be something that anyone should be forced to watch. I do think that probably because NBC passed on it and they ended up on this Spectrum thing, which is, I'm not really sure what that is. You know, they're not as beholden to broadcast network standards. So that probably means, you know, hey, lady in the thong, and hey, more violence, and all that stuff. But it just, it's a lose for everyone.
Yeah, it's funny. What you think about violence, I'm realizing you're so right, because in the pilot, which maybe was sort of originally designed to be on a broadcast show, there's a moment towards the end where, and again, it just feels like it takes this weird leap. You know, one of the main characters shoots one of the bad guys, and like it cuts to a slow motion shot of the bullet like exploding into his head. And listen, again, I am not someone who is anti-violence by any means in entertainment. I am a pacifist and a wimp in real life, but like I just the weirdness with which that stuff is thrown into material that is just so goofy, it winds up leaving a bad taste in your mouth all around.
That sequence comes at the end of an episode where there is a child, a young boy, taken hostage and repeatedly traumatized by bad guys, taken hostage, retaken hostage, is freaking nanny is murdered,
killed in front of him.
And like, so then, like, on top of all that, like, so not only have you traumatized this child character multiple times throughout the course of this one episode, you're then going to finally end his trauma by slow-mo-ing a bullet into the brain of the bad guy, and we're supposed to be like, woohoo, victory! Yeah.
It's such a strange tone that the show is hitting. And even you'd mentioned earlier on, Kristen, the quips are not good quips.
Nope.
There is, so Zach Guilford and Dwayne Martin co-star as these two other detectives called the Bens, because their names are both Ben. Zach Guilford, of course, is a white man. Dwayne Martin is an African-American. And there's a scene where they enter a room and someone refers to them as Black Man and Robin. And I almost picked up my laptop that I was watching the screener on and threw it out the window at that point.
Yeah.
And it's just, and again, it's interesting, Kristen, because this show is kind of existing as a spinoff of a major franchise, and that kind of thing happens a lot nowadays. And it just sort of feels like you would think, certainly the participation of Gabrielle Union and Jessica Alba. Jessica Alba, who I think is involved in a billion-dollar company in her spare time.
Somebody told me she's worth $400 million. daughters. Like, honey, you don't need to work.
You would you would just think that their participation in this would imply a feeling of, you know, there's something interesting here. There's something we can actually do with this material. And so I think in that sense, even the relatively low bar of trying to create a fun, you know, outrageous action comedy, it doesn't even really, you know, get up to that level, which is really a shame.
I do just think that maybe we've lost sight, and by we, I mean executives who greenlight this stuff, have lost sight of, you know, just sort of a simple litmus test that they should do when they're looking at a property. Like, did anyone ask for, like, more Bad Boys content? No, nobody did. I understand they're making a third movie or whatever, and, like, the original people are in it, and fine. But did anyone ask for a Bad Boys spin-off of a sort of secondary character who happens, you know, to be a good actress? But did anyone ask for that? No, they didn't. They didn't. Why don't you give Gabrielle Union a different role that is worthy of her? Give her a show. I'm happy to have her have a show. She's great. I can say that with slightly less enthusiasm for Jessica Alba, though I did enjoy the movie Honey. You know,
there we go.
Give her a show. Fine. But, like, not this show. Not this show that it sort of struts about as though it is doing something empowering and new. And in fact, it is sort of diminishing and degrading all the characters involved in a variety of very depressing ways.
Perfectly stated, Kristen. The show debuts May 13th on the Spectrum cable service, which, again, I do have access to. Maybe that's why it's LA's finest, because here in California, people will get all of the local references and be equally horrified by
them. Yes. Oh, our producer Patrick has something he wants to say.
I just want to say that now I want to see it, because I want to really see how bad this TV show is.
I mean, that it could maybe our rage will fuel some.
It's possible. Yeah. It's possible. Patrick would be excited to hear what you think about it. Are you a Bad Boys person at all?
I did like Bad Boys.
Okay, so even so, this is a pretty low rent version of that.
Yeah.
So.
I feel like what this show was going for was Lethal Weapon, and that show, for all its behind the scenes drama, at least in the first season, I thought was pretty good. And this was like trying to do the same thing, but just like failing on every level.
Yeah, well, because like the Lethal Weapon show, it's goofy, and it's not necessarily trying to be anything but goofy, and like especially weirdly when they added in Sean William Scott, it kind of got even better because he's just even goofier. But yeah, it's trying for that, but with, you know, oh god, an awful like assault backstory that just does not feel like the show is ready to handle that in any meaningful way.
Yeah, so basically, it bad. It real bad.
It bad. It real bad. That's our critical take. But of course, we love hearing what other people think about the TV shows that we talk about. Hey, if you want to tweet at us, I'm at Darren Franich on Twitter. She's at Kristen G. Baldwin. And while you're tweeting, while you're just doing stuff related to the stuff that we do, you can find our podcast anywhere podcasts are. Go over to Apple Podcasts, go to radio.com, go to Spotify. We are critics, which means we write reviews, which means we love reading reviews, which means we love reading your reviews. Let us know what you think about this show. We're trying to improve it every week, trying to make it the best version of itself, more the Fleabag version of itself than the LA's finest version of itself, but we'll settle for catch 22. I should have a catchphrase, but I don't, so goodbye.